07 and 09. For the most part, we went through the bills and have agreement. There's one outstanding issue. I'm told by my committee members that there's not a majority to move the bills to the floor of the Senate. And so the reposting the bills for tomorrow morning, and those bills will be held over till tomorrow morning at about 8:30. So we're going to do that, just so you know. Anybody here who's here for HIPAA bills, you know what the issue is. The issue is not resolved by tomorrow morning. I guess we'll be holding them over again, so until I get a majority of the members of the committee to move the bills. With that, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Wait, do you have one here? Which ones do you have?
I have 599 and
okay. The public hearing on Senate Bill 599. What do we have for that? All right, Mr. Austin. Jim Austin. You're it. Wait, Senator Hester? Is this your bill? Well, Jim? No, thanks. That's okay. Come on up here, Ray. I didn't notice you kind of hovering in the background.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Senate Bill 599, as a number of yours on your docket, Mr. Chairman, deal with the issue of identity theft. I will tell you right off the bat that there certainly may be some definitional issues that need to be worked on and certainly very predisposed to, should the committee have an interest in the concept of the legislation, be happy to work with those. But what 599 does makes it very, very clear that the action of identity theft and the impact that it has on the individual is substantial enough that the laws of the state of Oregon should protect those individuals who have been harmed by such action. The concept of Senate Bill 599 allows any individual to bring a civil action against another who negligently stores, transmits, or disposes of personal identification to the extent that it creates harm to the other individual. Secondly, it also puts the burden on that individual who created that harm to correct any credit rating difficulties that the victim of the identity theft has suffered. And I think, and you have probably heard too, Mr. Chairman, in your committee and elsewhere, not only is there the problem of the identity theft and the financial loss that it often creates for individuals, but long after that, people go on and on and on trying to solve their credit rating from which this problem has been created, and no one is there to help them, especially those who created the problem in the first place. And above all, I do believe that it's incumbent on those who created the problem to be responsible to make sure that an individual is restored. You know, I think this is the same principle we do with automobile insurance all the time. And when you your car is wrecked, you take it to the body shop, and the insurance that you have for that that vehicle is required to restore the vehicle to the condition it was prior to the accident. But we don't have anything like in statute to restore your credit rating to where it was at the time the act was committed. I think if there is a preponderance of evidence that because of negligence, and that's the key word in this piece of legislation, it's negligence that created the identity theft to occur, then there should be some action that an individual can take against that. I do understand, Mr. Chairman, there may be, as I mentioned earlier, some work on definitions to make sure that this is properly applied and someone does not unfairly get caught into a civil damage suit when negligence really was not created by them. And to the extent that there is any work that needs to be done on that, I am more and more happy to work on that. But I think if we accept the principle that someone is negligent and as a result harms another person in this growing problem of identity theft, then I think the state should make it very, very clear that there is a responsibility on those parties to correct and make whole those individuals. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude.
All right, Senator Metzger, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Senator Metzger? There are none. Mr. Austin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, good morning. My name is Jim Austin. I'm today representing American Express here. And we go along with the rationale of Senator Metzger's explanation on this situation and the fact that it does create another cause of action. The term negligently stored leaves that definition open-ended, and what we're concerned with is that there could be some problems down the road, as this could being left open-ended could be interpreted in a lot of different manners. So in talking with the senator, we've asked that we work with him and others who are interested to try to put some parameters around that definition. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Britting.
I actually thought of a question for Senator Metzger.
Uh-oh.
After I heard.
There he is. He's still in the audience, so good.
Senator Metzger, you talk about the negligently stored, transmitted, or disposed of. Isn't the primary problem here the disposal of records that, for example, companies that don't shred records when they're disposing them?
Well, I don't know if I could, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I don't know, Senator, whether I can tell you that that's the primary issue. I mean, it may very well be the greatest problem. But I can give you an example of others in terms of storage. Just to make up a situation, let's say you were an institution that was entrusted with your personal information, and this individual decided to, who worked for this organization, decided to do some work at home, and they took their computer and put your information on a disk, and they put that disk in the front of their car and went to Fred Meyer and left the car unlocked, and someone walked in and took it. Well, they weren't disposing of it, but their negligence in that case of taking your personal information out of the business and quote, in that case, storing it in the front seat of an open car would be considered, I think, negligence. Now, whether or not that is the dominant factor, I don't know. Certainly some of the high-profile situations we've heard of are individuals or organizations that have been negligent in disposing of information, the famous dumpster, in the back of Wells Fargo Bank, et cetera. And what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, is that we've had other ways to attack this in the past about, you know, shredding and others, and this does not compel any organization to take any particular steps, shredding or otherwise. It just says that you can do whatever you want, but if you're negligent, then you're going to be responsible.
Very much, because I do hear the concern about it. If it's written very, very broadly, I could see the concerns about that.
But certainly.
I also heard you earlier saying that you were willing to work to make it something that was that would do the job, but maybe not be overly broad.
Absolutely.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Farrelly.
Now, I do have just a couple of observations, at least one question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Could the term negligence include the negligence of an employer who hires an individual to work in a credit bureau or in a business that transmits and receives credit information and then uses that privileged position to acquire credit data and then transmit it to third parties for illegal purposes? I guess what I'm trying to get at is not just mere negligence, but criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And usually what happens, I don't think people dumpster dive as much as folks think, but I think there was an organized attempt to crack into credit bureaus and sending and receiving institutions and steal the information and transmit it to third parties.
Yeah. That's a good point, Senator. I can't tell you whether this definition would fit that, but I think you raise a very, very important point.
Okay, but I guess the negligence there would be an employer not doing sufficient background information on the potential employee, or failing to stop that activity, or failing to even be able to detect that activity. So I'm hoping that the definition of negligence is broad enough to cover those actions.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, if I
yes.
could follow on. The only other thing is banks and lending institutions and credit card agencies have a $50 limit on the loss that can be incurred by an account holder in the event that their information is stolen and misused. I don't know whether the credit agencies have a similar stop loss, but the loss of a credit rating is certainly greater damage than you'd incur from a theft of your identity if it's used on a credit card. So I just wondered if there was any discussion in the framing of the bill to cause credit associations to help the, stop the losses at a certain amount. This indicates that they would help repair credit ratings and financial records, but it says nothing about any accrued financial losses that relate directly to the credit rate theft or the credit information theft. Is there any discussion about, you know, putting some real liability in this for the credit reporter to stop the theft, or if the theft is detected, to stop the misuse of the credit information?
No, Senator. I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I mean, I think that's a very valid argument. I mean, you're moving to a next level there, and I think there certainly is value that. I think the point that you brought up about some of the credit card companies, you know, already limiting, you know, their cost, I think is very legitimate. And then you have others that create tremendous financial loss for other reasons that would not be limited. And that's one reason that the restoring of credit was critical, because, like you say, I mean, I might have lost $50 here, but if I can't get credit for my next house, my next car, because, you know, no one's helping me find out that I was not, you know, the same Charlie Ringo that that I was misrepresented to be, then could create
facts.
Some problems. Yes, but I think that's, you know, if you know, taking that next step is certainly a valid one, and one I think maybe we should consider.
A separate time, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. I've got a couple of questions for counsel. In line 4 of the bill, it says any person who suffers damage by reason of the commission of identity theft suffers damage. Means what in a civil context? If you're looking at a plaintiff who comes to you and asks whether or not they can sue, does this give any direction with respect to what level of damage is required?
Well, I would suspect, Mr. Chairman, that any minimal level of damage, even nominal damages of $1, would be sufficient. Obviously, there would be the defense cost issue, but just looking at this, damage in this context usually means economic damage, but there's also the economic damage could be defined rather broadly, from losing a dollar to, you know, losing your credit rating. You'd actually have to prove that the credit rating somehow caused you to suffer economic harm. I don't think that just simply having a bad credit rating alone would be sufficient to constitute damages. It would have to be some kind of economic damages, I assume.
Okay. Then also it says that the civil action may be brought against any other person. Does that include a corporation or a business?
Corporations are typically considered to be in the same stead as individuals, but the fact that it says person there, I think that might be ambiguous as to whether it would include corporations. It's my understanding that it would be the intent of the sponsors to include corporations, but we might want to clarify that issue.
All right. As I see in Section 4 of the bill, it includes public bodies, but it isn't very clear with respect to corporations or other businesses.
Mr. Chairman, if I could,
Senator,
as you know, I'm not an attorney, so I think the counsel is wise in exploring that. However, when we wrote the bill, we went by the definition of person that is in statute, which does define corporations as persons. But if there's ambiguity about that, we certainly should clarify it, because that is the intent.
Right. Okay. All right. Other questions? There are none. Thank you very much. Julie Brandis, you sent me a message and said you'd like to chat about this. You're in team spirit today.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. I'm here today, barely making it, apologize, in opposition to Senate Bill 599. just to follow up some comments that have been said here today, and here today probably I'm best representing our retail members, the nation's largest retailers who offer their own credit or who obviously use credit quite a bit. The bill seems overly broad in some respects, and it would be hard to – it's hard for us to understand how the total intent of the law. For example, when we take a credit receipt from a customer, generally what we do is that becomes part of our – it's just like – in many respects, it's just like handling cash. So we have a merchant's copy. We maintain that copy. We actually generally commit it to disk or microfiche, depending on how up-to-date the retailer is, and then the original document is shredded. We're not so sure that the broad impacts of the broad interpretation of this bill would require that, let's say, I take the receipt as the cardholder, and I just toss it in the garbage can, which is something I have been known to do, but it's on the premise of the retailer. So does the retailer then become somewhat negligent for having that in the garbage can? The other thing that has concern that our retailers have expressed concern on this bill about relates to opening up the courts to start to interpret when negligence occurred and how that relates to identity theft and identity protection, primarily because the courts would be covering a practice that is really already defined quite well in some of our federal statutes related to privacy or Gramm-Leach-Bleiling, how we treat credit information. So those are just some of the concerns that we'd like to express for the record and express in our opposition.
All right. Any questions of Ms. Brandes? There are none. Thank you. And yay team. Okay. Thank you. I think that's it. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on Senate Bill 599? If there's not, we'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 599. Thank you, Senator Metzger. Okay. Let's see. Do a public hearing, SJR2. This is intended to be a brief public hearing. Is there anyone here that would like to testify on SJR2? If not, counsel, just tell us for the record what SJR2 is intended to do.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. SJR2 proposes to allow a ballot measure to go to the voters on the issue of whether the Constitution should be amended to allow limitations on civil damages. You may recall, back in 1987, the legislature established a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages, so-called pain and suffering. That was later struck down by the courts in a decision called Lakin on the grounds that it violated Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution, Section 3, which states that the right to a jury trial is inviolate. Subsequent to that, a ballot measure was proposed to the voters, I think in 2000. That was defeated. This would be a similar ballot measure, again, asking the voters to vote on the issue of whether or not non-economic damages cap should be allowed by amending the Constitution to give the legislature the authority to do so.
All right.
Go ahead.
Questions of counsel, Senator Wolf?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Counsel, could you please tell us how much that ballot measure was defeated by, what the percentage of the vote was, please?
Actually, I don't know because I wasn't here in 2000. I was in another state, somewhat south of here.
I bet I could venture a guess that it was 2-1.
All right. Any other questions? All right, we'll close the hearing then. SJR 2. Thank you. Joseph, hopefully you're glad you're living in Oregon.
I'm very glad to be living in Oregon, thank you. I'm originally from Ohio, so.
All right. Senate Bill 782, Council friends, you're here on this issue. This is also a short.
Your Honor, excuse me, Senator Menes. Wow. Thank you, like,
haven't things. Quite got out of the court yet, have you?
No. This is a bill sponsored by Senator Burdick. Senate Bill 782 would change what was put into effect by Ballot Measure 11 for those people who are waived into adult court who are under 18. There would be no mandatory minimum sentences. They'd be presumptive. It also allows for Currently, there's a maximum of 20% good time that can be earned on a sentence other than a Measure 11 sentence. This would change that for those offenders and would increase it to 25%. So if you had, you could get good time credits or for up to 25% of your sentence.
All right. Senator Burdick, do you want to speak to this bill at all?
Mr. Chairman, I sponsored this bill because I think it's, especially at a time of budget shortage, I think it's worth a discussion of whether we are getting our money's worth from Measure 11, and specifically with juveniles from any number of standpoints. I think we need to continue to look at how Measure 11 is affecting juveniles, and so I introduced this bill for purposes of discussion. Thank you.
All right. Is the bill limited to Measure 11 juveniles?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The way I read it, it would only apply to those who are 15, 16, or 17 years of age. Those people would still be waived into adult court, but would then the mandatory minimums would go away, and they would be presumptive sentences. And of course, then you have the sentencing guideline factors of aggravating or departing sentences that would be in place.
All right. Thank you. All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 782. Unless, is there anybody else here that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 782? All right, there's not. So, we're back to the top of our agenda. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 21.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 21 comes to you. It's from the Oregon Advocate Center. Bob Dundelf is here. Basically, this deals with people who are unable to aid and assist in their own defense. When a person is incapacitated by a mental disease or defect, there's a court hearing, and they are sent to a hospital. And under current law, it is the Oregon State Hospital. This measure is a response to some federal litigation that I'm sure Mr. Dundelf will be able to explain to you that made it clear that these incapacitated people cannot be held in jail while they're waiting for a treatment bed at Oregon State Hospital. There is a right for them to be treated within 7 days, basically, and that's what this would codify. It also would go, I know there are some amendments that I'm sure that the current bill would go beyond that to, in some extent, I believe, for those who are, that may be incapacitated, there is a section that would allow for them to be taken to a treatment facility or have a mental health professional evaluate them. It's my understanding that the amendments might change that portion. And then lastly, this would allow statutorily so that a person could go somewhere other than the Oregon State Hospital for treatment, meaning if there is not a bed available at Oregon State Hospital, they could go to another mental health facility.
All right. Great. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Dundelf. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. Senate Bill 21 is designed to codify the holding in Oregon Advocacy Center versus Mink. As counsel has told you, under present Oregon law, if it's suspected that a person is so mentally disabled that they can't understand what's going on in the criminal proceedings in which they become involved, a court can order that they be evaluated for mental competency. And if they're found to be incompetent, under present law, the judge has two options. One is just to release that individual back to the community, and the other option is to commit that person to the Oregon State Hospital. What's happened over the past few years because of tight budgets and limited bed space at Oregon State Hospital was that individuals have essentially backed up into the jail so that they've waited for weeks and months for a bed at the Oregon State Hospital. That spawned this litigation in the District Court in Oregon. Judge Panner in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held that a person who's been found unable to assist in their criminal proceedings needs to be transported to a treatment facility within 7 days. So Senate Bill 21 would do one thing. One thing that it would do would be to codify that 7-day requirement. The second thing that it would do is to recognize that we still have a problem with bed space at Oregon State Hospital. There's only so many beds, so much space, and if we have an increasing volume of folks that are sent there, the hospital is put in a tough situation in terms of having to potentially release people to make space who shouldn't be released. So what Senate Bill 21 would do would be to give the Department of Human Services the flexibility, if it so chooses, to designate additional treatment facilities for people to be sent to receive their treatment in order to be able to return and face their criminal charges. Now, there is another portion of the bill that's in sections 2 and 3 that have to do with that earlier part of the proceeding, and that is when, if a court suspects that a person is incapacitated, the court can order that person be evaluated. Sections 2 and 3 would also put time limits on how quickly those people have to be evaluated. However, -1 amendments have been submitted that would eliminate those requirements in recognition of the fact that those requirements would have an additional fiscal impact, and that that time frame was not the subject of the court litigation and therefore is not mandated. So, for those reasons, we would urge that that Senate Bill 21 be passed with the -1 amendments so that the 7-day time period would be codified in Oregon law, and that the Department of Human Services would have the flexibility, if it so chooses, to place individuals in locations other than Oregon State Hospital.
Questions,
Senator Walker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Junduff, I assume that there's a fiscal attached to the 7-day requirement as well, but because it's mandated, we have no choice. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I believe that's correct.
And follow-up question.
Sure.
Do you know what the fiscal would have been had we, if we don't pass the dash ones and leave the evaluation period in there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I don't know what the fiscal would be for that. Dr. Mazerhart from Oregon State Hospital is here. Perhaps he can respond to that question.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Bob. All right, Kelly Skye.
Good morning. Kelly Skye, legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Chair Menace, members of the committee. OCDLA supports this bill. Clients of the Public Defender's Office were involved in the federal litigation, and so we support the enactment of law to conform to the court's rulings in that case. We also strongly support the ability for the Department of Human Services to place these people who are unable to aid and assist in their defense in facilities other than the Oregon State Hospital. Where we see that frequently a problem is in low-level offenses. Because a person who is unable to aid and assist in their defense can be held only for the maximum period of time that they could have received were they convicted on the charge, frequently we get people who suffer from mental illness on Class C misdemeanors who have a maximum punishment of 30 days. And judges are very reluctant to commit someone in that situation to the state hospital for a period of 30 days, taking up bed space from other clients that they know need the treatment more. And this would allow the Department of Human Services to perhaps put them in a local facility. It would also allow for collaborating treatment and allowing for the person to be civilly committed and to the Department of Human Services at the same time that they are serving a commitment under the aid and assist statute. So we support this bill. And as to the amendments, at least in Multnomah County, I don't think that that's going to have a huge difference because most of those evaluations are actually done prior to the court hearing. So generally, a defense attorney will meet their client. They will sense whether there's an issue as to ability to aid and assist. They will get their own evaluation rather than it waiting until the court orders the person to be sent down to the state hospital. So I don't see it that those amendments will impede the treatment of individuals, at least in Multnomah County.
All right, questions of this guy? There are none. Thank you. All right. Stan, is it McGuire-Hart? Is that correct? Are you a doctor?
Sorry?
Are you a doctor?
Probably.
It's close enough. Your signature is kind of, you know. All right, sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stan Mazerhart. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, which is within the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to give a little bit more information on this bill and the department's perspective on it. Regarding the placement of individuals within the seven-day time frame, as indicated in Judge Panner's ruling, the bill is in alignment with that, and we understand our responsibilities to do that. A concern we have with the bill is the potential is the language that suggests assignment potentially to another treatment facility. There isn't a definition of other treatment facility, and this latitude of assignment wasn't requested by the department under 370 because we don't have the resources at this time to establish such other treatment facilities. It's our concern that the courts may take this as a responsibility for us to accomplish rather than simply a permissive statement that we may establish treatment facilities, in which case there would be financial difficulties for the department. Presently, the hospitalization rate at Oregon State Hospital is about $330 a day for forensic clients, and in a community psychiatric hospital, those rates are about $800 a day. So it would clearly have financial impacts in that regard. The department agrees with the changes that have been made, amendments that have been made under that affect the bill in the sections Mr. Jundeff mentioned regarding ORS 161365. That is the evaluation of folks as to whether they're able to aid and assist. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Sure. How are we doing with respect to the backlog of persons?
As of today, we are 31 patients over budgeted capacity in our forensic programs. We're budgeted for 374 beds. We have 404 patients, and of those, approximately 80 are committed to us under ORS 161370. Those two sections of the bill, Chairman, are very different. The 365, so-called 161365s, we do on an outpatient basis. We don't admit to the hospital. The 370s, 161370, folks that are committed to us are committed for treatment until able to aid and assist.
All right. And is there a backlog of persons? How are you dealing with the court's decision?
We're meeting it for the most part. I believe that we've had two cases since that decision last June, I believe it was, where we missed it. In one case, the individual had to go to a community hospital because of a medical condition. It's very difficult to meet within the current crowding situation and the budget reductions that we've experienced.
Okay. All right. And is the state appealing the decision by the Ninth Circuit Court?
As I understand it from the Department of Justice, that's still an open book.
Okay. Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I just was curious if the authority were granted under SB 21 to refer people to other facilities. Would that mean that the state hospital could clear 80 beds? I mean, where would these people go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, that's a good question, and I don't really have an answer to it. I doubt that it means we'd be able to clear that many beds because a number of those folks need a level of security that isn't going to be found in community settings. As previous testimony indicated, in the long run and down the road, it may well be possible to provide those services within the local community for what might be called lower-level offenders, where the crimes aren't as serious and the person doesn't represent as significant a risk to public safety.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the choice we have now, is send them to an authorized facility or send them down the road. And I think that's where most of them are ending up, is down the road.
All right. The language in the bill says, or and I'm reading from your text here, or the superintendent of another treatment facility designated by the Department of Human Services. It sounds to me like, you know, the Department of Human Services can designate another facility, so they have the ability to choose which facility, which ones might be certified or designated. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Is there a void of facilities out there that can handle these kind of patients, or is...
I'm not aware of ones that exist now that wouldn't require modifications and different programming for these individuals.
All right. Have any idea how other states are doing with respect to this issue?
Currently, the majority are doing it the other states are doing it in the same kind of manner that we are. And for length of stay for folks under 161370, we have about the same average length of stay for those folks as the majority of other states.
All right. How about backlogs of persons trying to get in? Or?
Well, we've been meeting the... backlogs in other states, sir?
Right.
I'm sorry, I don't have that.
I'm just wondering how we compare to other states, if you have a sense for that.
I don't have that information. I'll get it,
right,
though. One thing I'd correct, if I may,
sure,
correct from what I understood prior testimony, when we're full, we don't have the ability to release because we're full. We continue to admit as required under Judge Panner's decision because the release is determined by the person being finally determined as fit to proceed or not, in which case the court is notified and the person's returned to the court. If they're fit to proceed, they stay with us. If they're not, dependent on how long the sentence would be otherwise and so forth. But this isn't a case of being able to release due to overcrowding, for instance.
Right. And what's the capacity of your facility?
The budgeted capacity of our forensic programs right now are 374 beds.
What's the actual capacity? What's your maximum capacity?
We're licensed at... it's between 660 and 700.
660 to 700, but you're funded for...
Well, but we operate other programs, and the license doesn't apply just to the forensic programs.
All right, but I'm talking about forensic programs. How many spaces would you have? If you had all the money in the world, how many spaces without building a brand-new building?
Well, we'd have to open new wards. Within the wards we have, it's 374. But there is some, Chair Minister, there is some play in that the health division licenses hospitals overall for the number of beds that are used. The assignment of those beds within the institution is our determination.
Right. So for all of the programs, you have a maximum of 700?
It's between 660 and 700, sir.
All right.
I can get the exact number for you.
Well, it sounds like we're getting into some ways and means questions. And I think what we want to explore as far as the Judiciary Committee is whether or not this is good public policy and if the state, notwithstanding whether the state appeals the decision or not, how valid the policy is, and maybe send the thing to Ways and Means and let them consider it there. So I don't know whether this has a subsequent to Ways and Means. Yes, it does have a subsequent. So,
if I may, and there are two separate issues here in that sense of ways and means. I think one being, well, they're both ways and means implications, I suppose, due to caseload increase, which is primarily attributed to this population. But it's the 7-day piece and the alternative treatment facility piece.
All right. Thank you, Council.
Thank you. Mr. Mazur, I wanted to highlight something you said. You mentioned a concern about having to establish these facilities, these other treatment facilities.
Yes, sir.
Are you concerned about establishing rules as to which ones should be designated or actually establishing treatment facilities?
I would say both. And one of the concerns is that judges, when they realize what the crowding situation is at the state hospital, have asked us, and I happen at this point to be the assigning person within the department, and that isn't a difficult job because it's assigning to Oregon State Hospital is the choice, but that my concern is that judges will expect that we will produce other programs to assign folks to, and that isn't possible within the current situation. However, I don't want to take away from the idea that I think it's a good idea, particularly for down the road, that there are alternatives, particularly for lower-level crimes where there wouldn't have to be as intensive security, that folks could receive, possibly receive 370 treatment within the local community. And that would probably make it a lot easier for everybody who needs to work with those folks in getting them to trial.
All right. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was precisely what I'm sitting here thinking is, why don't you just reclassify some of these people and put them in community treatment facilities if they have a lower level of crime? Do you currently do that?
Chairman and Senator Walker, no, we don't do that.
Is it possible to do that?
I don't know that it is under the current law, but I'm not an attorney, so I'd have to go back and ask DOJ their feeling. We don't assign those folks elsewhere. The court assigns those folks.
Mm-hmm.
And there are cases where the court will assign those folks to the community under supervision, and that's allowed by the law. But we don't assign them that way. So on lesser offenses, the court can take that tact, and does in some cases.
And a further question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Wouldn't you assume that if you are not meeting the court's dicta here, their decision, wouldn't you assume that someone's going to sue the department for not getting them in within 7 days?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, our intent is to get them in within 7 days, and we've done very well in that regard since the decision. And have not had complaints. At the same time, we're significantly over budgeted capacity.
That's my point.
Senator, are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. You said that it costs $330 a day to keep them in the Oregon State Hospital, but $800 a day in community treatment?
That's my understanding of the current rates as we use them under the acute care contract.
Why is that? Why is it so much more expensive than a community setting?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I don't know all the costs that go into that for the community setting. I can account for ours, but I could get some comparisons for you. And these, if I may add, and these folks are all within the general fund. These aren't cases that can be matched, as I understand it, with federal money.
That's another issue with your hospital. Do your folks get Medicaid match or not?
We do, Mr. Chair, we do within our adolescent and our geropsychiatric treatment programs. We don't in forensics. It's not allowed by federal rules for folks who are incarcerated.
So if they're incarcerated or
that's
evaluated pending trial?
That's correct.
And they do not.
That stops at the point of the initial incarceration, as I understand it.
All right. All right. Senator Walker, another question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just thinking we need to go down to Ways and Means of this bill and play with it because increasingly we've had more and more people with mental disabilities in our prison system, and I think this is good policy, and I think maybe the court might consider shifting the way it assigns these folks to perhaps assist the state hospital. And I also think Senator Burdick's question is a good one. Why is it $800? Economies of scale work to our advantage at the state hospital, but that's a significant difference. And I think the Ways and Means folks can deal with that quite well.
All right. Senator Burdick?
Well, before we send it to Ways and Means, I would want to resolve some of the issues that were brought up by what another treatment facility means. I think that would be helpful to at least address that issue in this bill, because that's more of a policy issue, if that's possible to do in the limited time we have.
Okay. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, yes. We'd certainly be glad to work with the Oregon Advocacy Center to come to some understanding of what that means, and from our perspective, to be sure that without additional resources that it's clearly permissive in front of the courts and not mandated that we need to do that immediately.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 21? There is not. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 21. Hopefully get some additional work done on it with respect to definitions. The last bill up today, Senator Ringo is not here, though, is he? Why don't we recess for 5 minutes? We'll see if we can round up Senator Ringo, since this is his bill. And
are we not going to work session on this?
No, because